Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.
Now, you're very welcome back. Bright start for Kilkenny at home to Galway. 2-1 after 4 minutes is the latest there. We'll be over and back to Tommy Welch across the first half and Mossy Quinn, who is watching Laois against Meath at Croke Park. In the meantime, we're going to review the Sunday papers as ever on Sunday. We have journalist David Snaid with us, and we have Shane Keegan as well, former League of Ireland manager, whose work you can read in the Times Online. I'll start you off with the front pages. You can get this on Facebook Live as well or any of our social channels if you want to stream it. Sunday Times, their front page has taken a grip. Donegal put squeeze and Tyrone to reach Ulster Championship final. A picture there of Kieran McGeary held back by Donegal's Niall O'Donnell. And then on the right-hand side, Danes mock Irish football as boring. Thomas Delaney, who did sort of mean this as a compliment as well, said that playing against Ireland is a pain in the ass in both a positive way and a negative way. The last time Delaney played Ireland, he said it was like trying to open a can of beans with your bare hands. He seems to find good analogies for playing against Ireland. Yeah. Back page of the Sunday Mirror then, unfinished symphony. McCarthy's enjoying the mood music around the Irish camp, but he insists it could fall flat unless we rock in Gibraltar. It sure could. He said if the result has created mood music, it's good music. Good mood music, but talks about the importance of not doing anything silly tomorrow night against Gibraltar. Donegal feature again next here on the Sunday Independent. It's their main picture you'll see here, Murphy's Law, Michael Murphy. Donegal ace shines as Tyrone must take long road back to Croke Park. And then bottom story here, Brady keen to build on priceless point. That's Robbie Brady again. Very cognizant of the fact that doing something silly tomorrow night would not be good. Mail on Sunday boasts an exclusive here with Johnny Sexton on their back page. I've been criticised for everything, my tackling, my kicking and my personality. That's Shane McGrath with Johnny Sexton inside. We'll touch on that. And then Keane O'Neill, the Kildare manager, I hope he's not bothering to read the papers on the morning of today's match against Dublin. Kildare are a soft touch. O'Neill has to go. That's Andrew McLaughlin, former Kildare player, with his fairly withering verdict on how they're shaping up in 2019. Star on Sunday, nowhere man. This is Gareth Southgate, not about to ditch three lines. He's staying where he is. Gareth Southgate is very much the word from the English camp. Then back page of The Sun, a bum rap, Delaney, this is Thomas Delaney again. Ireland are a pain in the ass to take on. And those of you not streaming will not see the very nice photo. Thomas Delaney on his back, arse in the air, just to really rump home the point.
Rump.
There you go, we're all at it. Sunday World, back page, Klopp's Dutch of class, John Aldridge here. Sunday World columnist saying that Jurgen Klopp should swoop in and take Matthijs de Ligt to Liverpool. That would be quite the centre-half pairing, wouldn't it? De Ligt and Van Dijk for the next decade. They are your back pages. We will start with the Sunday Times main section. It now sends a shiver down the spine of all Sunday paper participants whenever Mark Tighe tweets that he's got a John Delaney story the next day. And that was the case last night. So it wasn't quite on the front page. It's on page 3 here of the Sunday Times main section. Ex-FAI boss Delaney scored match tickets for Shane Ross is the story. John Fallon and Mark Tighe. Story here, David, very simply, is that Shane Ross, the sports minister, received match tickets for the 2017 Europa League final. That was in Stockholm. That was the Manchester United Ajax Europa League final. He attended the game in a private capacity. He's understood to have paid for the tickets by cheque. That's the gist of the story.
Yeah, yeah. No, it was, as you say, I kind of got wind of the story yesterday evening. It's obviously Mark Tighe and John Fallon, who have obviously both been all over this for the last, it feels like a lot longer than maybe a couple of months. It feels as if I don't think I've ever not read a Mark Tighe story in my life. No, like every single day. But, yeah, it's like, I know it's, maybe it's not on page one, so maybe it's not going to maybe kind of dominate as some of the previous stories, but...
Didn't strike me as a scandal.
No, it's not a scandal, but it just plays into just the relationships and everything that's what been happening over the last number of years in Irish football, just with Shane Ross, with John Delaney. Obviously, we know
the coziness of the relationship.
Yeah, yeah. Like we've seen this week in other aspects, I'm sure we'll touch on later on. Like Shane Ross, any good politician, he's just the ultimate opportunist. So when the moment comes where he no longer sees your views, that's what he's done with Delaney and being very critical. Whereas before, he was very happy to use him when he saw fit to go and see United play Ajax in the Europa League. And that's why it's important. It's, yeah, as you say, it's not a scandal, but it just shows you basically how things have been working, you know.
Mark Tighe and John Fallon write as well. Last November, Ross praised the work that Delaney was doing in a News Talk interview. That was Jonathan Healey with the interview in which the minister was asked about fans' concerns over Delaney's performance as chief executive. And Ross dismissed the concerns and said everything he'd heard about Delaney was good and positive. And I guess this ties in with what does seem like a very cosy relationship.
Yeah, he saw the tide was turning, that basically Delaney was kind of too much had happened and he was no longer in the position of power that he was. And it also, around that time as well, I think The Sun had that story not so long ago about the fact that Shane Ross did intervene as well to get a grant for the FAI that had been rejected by Sport Ireland. I think it was €195,000 to get that really kind of, to kind of get that back on the table for them essentially as well, you know. So that's how it's worked, and that's why this story, in the overall grand scheme of things, and I don't know how long, when Mark Tighe is writing the book, and I'm guessing there's probably a book in it now, it's just another part of the puzzle for people to kind of understand how things have worked.
Shane?
Yeah, look, I suppose Mark's landed some absolutely knockout blows over the last couple of months. This is more like a kind of a light body punch than it is a knockout blow. I don't think there's anything massive in it. As you say, David fired me a text last night when he got wind of it, and I thought, oh no, are we going to spend the entire show talking about stuff that's not actually directly sports related? But I think, look, if you can point me pretty much anybody involved in sport in this country who hasn't tried to use their connections to get tickets for sporting events, you'll do well to find anybody, you know. Obviously, look, he's in a different capacity, you know, it makes it a bit more serious, but I think this is, you know, this is not something that we're going to... It's as people keep talking about the reeling in the ears when we come to sit down to watch it, this won't make the reeling in the ears highlights as much as the rest of the stuff, I don't think.
Yeah, I would agree. I would stress from my point of view as a journalist, from the actual news story aspect of it, take my hat off to John and Mark again, because yeah, as you say, like, everyone can kind of, you know, will try and get tickets or whatever, but it's just, again, it just helps paint that picture and kind of fills in a couple of dots. So when people are saying how vocal Shane Ross has been over the last while, well, hasn't always been that way, you know.
Yeah, and I think that is the point.
And that's why it's important, even from Shane Ross's point of view, even more so not from the FAI, just like this fella, like, he's just like,
he's come late to the story, that's for sure. Yeah. The Sunday Times as well established last year Delaney provided hundreds of tickets for an Irish home game to Wayside Celtic. Wayside Celtic are a club in Ross's constituency, and Delaney credited the minister for securing them. And then they go on to write that June 17th last year, both Delaney and Ross attended an event at Wayside Celtic to present medals and trophies. In a speech, Delaney thanked Ross for all the financial support he'd given to Irish football. He then proceeded to say that thanks to an intervention by Ross, the FAI would be able to make available hundreds of match tickets to the club's children and parents for Ireland's match against Denmark last October, a nil-all draw. It's understood the FAI provided about 700 tickets to the club. They go on to say, in a speech in the day, Ross said, "I hope to see you all in the Aviva in the autumn, because John Delaney, he's not like a politician, he keeps his promises." In a statement this weekend, then, Ross has said, "I never asked John Delaney or anybody else in the FAI to provide any free tickets to any club for any match. His decision to give the tickets to Wayside Celtic in my presence was not at my request."
If anybody's got any camera phone clips of John and Shane that day, it would be very, very interesting to see how much he was trying to deny it at the time.
Plenty out there. It is likely, Ross continues, "It is likely that this was in line..." The granting of the tickets, this was in line with FAI policy to disperse free tickets to supporters for international matches rather than leave the seats empty. And that certainly was going on around that time, the Wales, Northern Ireland, Denmark matches, when the O'Neill, Keane, Sheen had fallen off and they were struggling to fill seats. They were definitely giving out free tickets. FAI sources said Delaney had wide-ranging power to allocate tickets to clubs and people of his choosing. So Shane Ross had nothing to do with club and his constituency receiving 700 tickets, courtesy of John Delaney. This is how politics works, you know.
He's quite the ability to wear a lot of hats, Shane, in fairness, doesn't he? He's as we see in the Indo today as well, he's become Ireland's favourite sports journalist at the moment as well.
Is there anything more to be said on this situation, the tickets either way for Wayside Celtic or the Europa League, before we move on to Shane Ross's own column in the Sunday Independent? Is that about it?
I think, yeah, like, I'm not going to lie, I got off a plane coming home from Copenhagen, absolutely buzzing with Ireland, getting a result, thinking that's going to be great talking about Irish football, and then we're talking about Shane Ross.
We can still talk about Irish football.
It's important to talk about this. Yeah, no, that's what I said earlier as well. It paints the picture of what's been happening for the last while, and the relationship with John Delaney and Shane Ross, and that as a like Shane Ross, obviously serving minister, he saw where things were going with John Delaney, and very opportunistically got on board when he realised that there was something in it for him.
Shane Ross is writing his own column today again in the Sunday Independent. The headline is, Katie's homecoming was a pure paradise for a minister with a monstrous ego. In his own column, we should celebrate our sporting triumphs even when the heroes are as modest as Katie, writes Shane Ross. So for people who haven't read this, what is Shane Ross talking about today? Obviously it's him and Katie Taylor's homecoming.
First thing I will say is, in fairness, I found it very entertaining. I did find it a good read and found it very entertaining. What he's done essentially is, politicians are obviously well known for jumping on the bandwagon. Mm-hmm. There's no greater bandwagon at the moment than taking the piss out of Shane Ross. So he's decided to jump onto that bandwagon and take the piss out of Shane Ross. And he's done it very well. It is quite entertaining. Like he goes in hard on himself. This I hadn't heard this phrase political donut before. I don't know if you're more aware of it, but he throws out all the throws out all the stuff that everybody else has been saying about him and says, yeah, I'm this and I'm that, and you know, aren't I a fool? And
a political donut, by the way, as he writes, are there sinners who love to be pictured with more charismatic or more popular figures than themselves? Not difficult for many of us mere mortals, he says. So he is a self-confessed political donut here. And he says, hands up, Katie is one of my heroes.
I'm delighted for him. Fair play to him. Well done. He's like, I just found it self-indulgent.
Go on, give me a section then.
Quite
lots of people listening wouldn't have read it.
So, where he says here, kind of, well, my best friends would never call me a shy retiring type. I wanted a big celebration for the world champion from Bray is. Unlike most politicians, loath to linger in the limelight. Mm. It goes on a bit, kind of saying all that. Basically, Kate says Katie is unique. She dislikes the formal trappings. Meeting her off the plane was a moment of poignancy. I'm sort of thinking, right, but that shouldn't have been a moment that you were there.
Well, hang on though, okay.
Like, he talks about having a civil ceremony for her in terms of a reception.
Yeah.
That's where it should have happened. Not in the airport coming back when, for some reason now, people are talking about him getting involved in that. Like, do it there in a more formal aspect where she's been invited and she knows what's going to happen. Mm. Like, I felt as if she was ambushed here. Now she's like, listen, she's going to handle us. she's not bothered by Shane Ross. Like, but I don't know. I just found that when I saw people were commenting, I just thought it was a bit vulgar almost from a politician to be so blatant. Mm. And then to do it like this, as you say, it is entertaining when you read it. It's very well written. I'd imagine it's ghostwritten.
History as a journalist, I'd say he's writing his own stuff.
But like, I don't know, I just found it very self-indulgent and a way of maybe kind of, as you say, getting in on the act himself. He's smart with it, as you say, he's kicking himself. He knows that there was no point in him coming out defending himself, saying, well, even though he is doing it, he has done it in a smart way, but I still think it's very self-indulgent. For someone who says himself he has a monstrous ego, is no surprise.
Yeah, he says, make no mistake, I was delighted to be there, and whichever way you turn, there were cameras, dozens of them. Not an ideal setting for a modest world champion. Paradise, though, for a minister with a monstrous ego. Exclamation mark. Ha ha ha. He then goes on to say, the joyous occasion raised a serious point, and I put this to both of you. The joyous occasion raised a serious point. Surely, government ministers should give appropriate welcomes to sports heroes returning home in triumph. Says he's been lucky to greet great footballers fresh from the Euros, the women's hockey team. I'll come back to that in a second, hockey team, because that was a stunt. The hockey team in the World Cup, the brilliant athletes from the Special Olympics weighed down with medals following their victories. He says, if the government and the DAA had not arranged a welcome for Katie and others at the airport, I would have been rightly chastised by the media for snubbing her.
Yeah, but there's a way to do it. I don't think many people have an issue with him being there. Like,
he should be there as the sports minister,
absolutely,
shouldn't he?
He should be there. I think he should be there. Yeah, I would definitely think he should be there. And had he not done this ballroom dance around her, I think like it's just how cringe it looked. Mm. Is actually what I don't think people have a massive problem with him being there. I think they do realise that he probably
David doesn't want him anywhere near the
airport. Just the setting of it. That's what I thought was, as I said, was vulgar about it. He's a politician, so he's not going to step back. He's going to want to be seen. I understand that. I'm not totally naive on this, but like, I think he mentions about kind of how he spoke to Brian Peters about it and he didn't want something made.
Civil reception. So he figured that was the only way to actually welcome her officially, because she didn't want a civil reception.
Well, it says here, after a lot of arm twisting, Katie agreed to an informal welcome at Dublin Airport. She and our manager, Brian Peters, were not keen for the jamboree. Katie is admirably low-key. So in that instance, well, then you'd be low-key, except that we're still what, say, Michael D. Higgins does, send out a statement. And if you're there at the end of it, don't be there at the door coming through. Like, oh, really. That's what I'm saying. Like,
he almost had one belt over the shoulder himself.
I know, yeah. But,
I think it was Kieran Cunningham, I think, put it best during the week when he said it was the best man marking job he'd seen since Lara Corbett on Tommy Walsh. Yeah. He was that tight. The one bit of insight that he gives, and I would love to know, was this definitely the case? Because if it is the case, it's just remarkable. An hour after her loss in Rio, I left the boxing ring complex, got into the car to head to another event. Suddenly, on the side of a dusty Rio road, I spotted two women alone, pulling their suitcases in search of a taxi. They were Katie and her mother, Bridget. Now that, I found that amazing.
Yeah. That can't be right, can it?
No.
That's exactly my thoughts. I was like, he can't say that unless it happened. Surely somebody pulls him up on that if that didn't happen. And if it did happen, it's
just
amazing.
My thoughts were, instead of Katie Taylor and her mother venturing out onto a dusty, deserted Brazilian road, would they not have just called a taxi to the hotel? Why would they be just out there hoping to come across a taxi? That's why I just thought it seemed like an odd scene that he had painted.
Sure, you'll get clarified for down the line. They'll probably be asked about
truth?
It. You know?
Maybe there's part truth in it. But oh, well, listen, he's dramatised it for our sakes, maybe. Yeah. I don't know.
But he's saying, like, an hour after her loss in Rio, I left the boxing ring complex and then met the two women. Like, an hour after her fight, is she going to be packed up and on a dusty road and...
Was there some sort of protocols after a fight?
I just would have thought there might be testing, there might be interviews. She might need a shower. I don't know. It just seemed like a hell of an exit. But
well, I wasn't there. It'd be interesting. I'm sure people who are actually in Rio would probably know that, because journalists who are covering it would not have said.
I'd also imagine John Tracy and people involved in Olympic Ireland would have a problem with this, because they're being painted in a poor light here if this is how they're, you know, effectively being seen to treat their athletes, you know?
Yeah. He talks here, though, about the hockey situation. Like, you'll remember the women's hockey team came back and then they were brought into a room and he announced that there was 1.5 million.
Yeah, yeah.
And before he'd even finished the sentence, they were all, you know, they thought literally 1.5 million was going to Irish hockey.
Mm.
Now, having since spoken to several, and we'll keep them anonymous, players on the hockey team, they were just brought off a plane into that room. They did not know what was being unleashed on them. This was a complete stunt. This was political hackery. That's what that was. They weren't told, we're going into a room, the minister's going to make an announcement for this. It was just right this way, this way, this way. Walk into a room, cameras everywhere. Shane Ross, 1.5 million.
But maybe...
That is the way this whole thing operates, and it is shady, and everybody can see through it. That is the thing with Shane
Ross.
What you'd hope. Nobody looked at Katie Taylor's homecoming and said, I have a deep, inexplicable, but uncontrollable urge to vote Shane Ross number one at the next general election. Nobody thought that.
I'm just curious, and I don't know, you're saying there about, obviously, the government have to acknowledge it, but does any sports person who achieves that in life, when they are coming back off a plane, think, I really, really, really want the sports minister to be there to say hello and to congratulate me?
Absolutely not.
And I've been kind of maybe sort of derogatory about his antics, and I'll hold my hands up. Maybe if in that situation where he says about Rio, where he met them and he was kind of, he saw how upset they were and maybe have got a bit of a relationship, maybe it is more than just a sport or kind
opportunism.
And maybe it is. And do you know what? I don't cover the Katie Taylor beat in terms of boxing. Like, I don't know what her relationship is with it. If it is more than just say he's a sports minister, if they remember that, maybe she...
Well, for me, I think he should be there at the airport to welcome people who've done great things home. Just do it in a slightly more tasteful manner.
I enjoyed the way he finished the column as well with his word of warning for Shane Duffy. Shane Duffy, the hero who scored the equaliser that saved the day for Ireland in Copenhagen last Friday night, should beware. I will spare him this time, but if he repeats it against Switzerland in the autumn, I will be waiting for him at the airport.
Exclamation mark. Well, hey, has he just started writing columns again for the Sunday Independent? Is that what's going on here? He wrote one a couple of weeks ago on Noel Mooney, and now he's written this one. Is he just now part-time columnist, Boris Johnson style? Anyway, let's go to Nolan Park. Tommy Welsh, 24 minutes gone. This looks like a good game. Kilkenny 1-7, Galway 1-6.
Well, Joe, the Leinster Championship is alive and kicking. What a game we have here at Nolan Park. It's unbelievable. player, like, I'm just looking at who's playing well. There's probably 8, 10 lads going well for Kilkenny. Hugh Lawler, Tommy Welch in the caller, Bill Sheehan, the new man in the corner forward. TJ Reid is giving a tour de force. Paddy Deegan just playing absolutely out of their skins. For Galway, Joseph Cooney back from Australia, hurling a stormer on the half back line. Carl Mannion has 3 points so far. Dahi Burke is having an unbelievable battle with Colin Fenley on the edge of the square. It's just end to end. Just to tell you about the two goals, TJ Reid's goal, he got a pass from Colin Fenley about 25 yards out. He was all on his own and just absolutely rattled it and lifted the crowd out of it. For Galway, Conor Whelan got the ball. He's really dangerous, Joe. About 22 or 3 yards out, turned Paul Murphy, was kind of getting fouled, but stayed going and going and put it, belted it to the bottom right hand corner of the net. It's just an unbelievable game. And why is it, Joe, you always hear me talking about man v man battles, where it's just you versus your man. Use your skills, use your will to win the ball, and that's what's going on. It's just everyone just going at it, and you're on your own here until a lad comes in to help you out. There's no sweepers, there's no real crazy tactics or anything. The half hours of both teams are helping back in their own defence, but then they're straight back up the field. It's now 1-8 to 7 points. Kilkenny in a 1 point lead, but just a magical, magical match, and the atmosphere is electric, Joe.
You're not going to make it till the end of this match.
We'll see.
Reid. Great stuff. Tommy Welch, Kilkenny 1-8, Galway 1-7. Brilliant game, 26 minutes gone in the sunshine at Nolan Park. Let's go to Croke Park. Mossy Quinn watching Meath against Laois. Close game here too, Mossy.
Close game, Joe. Not quite as magical so far. It was pretty poor for the first 15 minutes. It was 1-0 for a long time for Meath, and it's kicked into life a little bit in the last few minutes. 2 points from Colin Murphy for full forward at Laois, and corner forward James Conan. Just as Meath come in, and they've just missed a great goal chance. Killian O'Sullivan with a brilliant run right through the middle of the Laois defence, and he just pulled the shot just wide. But James Conan, late addition to the Meath team. He might be one of the guys we talked about stepping up, and he's a diminutive corner forward. He looks a little bit like he could be still playing minor out there. He's got 4 points from play. He's been the standout player so far. As we come, 27 minutes gone. Meath 5 points, Laois 4 points.
Okay, Mossy, thanks very much. Back to you at half time. So Meath 5, Laois 4. Elsewhere, qualifier underway. Half time, it's Monaghan 6 points, Fermanagh 1-2 in Clonas. And they're about 18 minutes into the game between Down and Tipperary at Port Gessler. It's Down 2 points, Tipperary 1 point. We're still here reviewing the Sunday papers. Shane Keegan and David Snaid with us. We'll leave Shane Ross, the Shane Ross section. We'll leave that for the time being. Let's turn to talk Leinster rugby. A few different pieces here. Johnny Sexton and that exclusive on the back page of the Mail is there. Mm. And then regarding the disciplinary issues and the fallout of late, the Sunday Independent has named the player at the centre of the alleged urinating saga. It's hard to come up with the exact words for these things. On legal advice, we won't be doing that just yet, but we can talk about the issue generally, and there are different pieces on the whole situation, both the Stan Wright situation where there was an alleged punch thrown against an academy player, and the urinating saga. Shane McGrath has, I think, a very good piece on page 69 of the Mail on Sunday. Brendan Fanning's talking about Leinster generally. Where are we jumping in here? What Shane McGrath is saying is no place left to hide for out-of-control athletes. And he starts off by saying one persistent myth has shattered in the heat of recent rugby scandals. And it's initially, well, there's several myths, but initially the one he's talking about is Joe Canning, even a couple of years ago, talking about how the rugby lads can enjoy a beer, no problem, whereas Gaa lads cut loose because of drinking bans. He said, this was Joe Canning's take on the topic 2 years ago, writes Shane McGrath. Before the Lions' third test, there were pictures of the players drinking a beer. After Ireland beat Italy at the Euros last year, there were pictures of them slugging bottles in the dressing room. It's fine, it's accepted, but the amateur athlete does it and it's frowned upon. And then Tomás O'Shea seized upon Canning's comments and said that inter-county players, it's tricky for them, that they can socialise like adults, professional players, because they don't face the same expectation to remain abstemious that GAA players face. As a consequence, they have their 3 or 4 beers routinely and leave it at that. When GAA lads drink, because it happens so rarely, they tend to lose the plot. Mm. And Shane McGrath saying that has often been the accepted narrative now in GAA culture. They look over almost enviously at rugby or at football, professional football, and they think, God, that's such a healthier attitude to drink. But as Shane McGrath writes, the recent events would suggest that rugby players are just as prone to absolutely cut loose as anyone around.
It's like anyone as well. Shane makes a few points in his column, and it is very good. Kind of just different, as you say, he touches on that point about the different relationships maybe between Gaelic footballers, rugby players, football players. Then he talks about the wider issue of just people's relationship with alcohol in Ireland and sports people. Makes one. I actually didn't realise that there's been no competition sponsored by in GAA or inter-county team for like 5 years or something.
Yeah, they banned it. They stopped doing it.
Yeah, so like, which I actually wasn't aware of. So that's interesting. And then
it used to be the Guinness Hurling Championship.
Yeah, yeah. And then the point which he finishes off on as an outro, which is basically what every player person knows. You cannot get away with anything anymore. Like he says it before about how maybe before things were kind of almost rumour and kind of there was whispers here and there, whereas now everyone knows straight away if you've done something more than, if you have to be very lucky not for it to be snapped, not for someone to have seen it and for it to end up online, etc. And that players just have, unless they're in the safety of their own home or someone's home, have no way, there is no privacy. And yeah, it was interesting about alcohol. I'm just going to mention the game on Friday because I was there. Everyone on the ground was drinking.
In Copenhagen.
Like, there was crates, I took a picture of it, there was crates in the club shop of Carlsberg. And people were going in and everyone was drinking in the stands. People were off their heads. Like, there was lads stumbling around near the press box because the press box in Copenhagen was basically part of the stands, you know, separate. And afterwards, when Denmark scored, literally drink was coming, getting thrown down. Like Randolph nearly got hit by a pint, but it's all in plastic glasses. But it was raining down. So it's not just this an Irish thing, you know what I mean? But it's just very interesting, the point Shane makes about, well, the most interesting point I think he makes is that players when they go out have to just realise they can't get away with this. Like this, if you behave in a way like what's being reported in today's Sunday in the paper, this isn't going to be swept under the carpet anymore. He says that himself in the column, one of the paragraphs. Like there's no hiding place. You're going to be held account, and that's now seems to be what's happening.
And I know you're not saying otherwise, but also it's not even about just getting away with it. Like if the alleged things that have happened and you get away with it, that is still not okay.
Yeah,
it's really grim. Like I would have thought we're past the point of having to just point out we're not in favour of urinating on other people.
That's disgusting.
We're all okay with that. We're all in agreement on that, are we? Like to say that for the record. And then the punch thrown is very, very serious as well. We'll come to that in a second in Brendan Fanning's piece. But I think Shane McGrath writes very well here, and I just totally agree with him. The fact is that sport in Ireland is sauced and drink inside and outside dressing rooms. The most prestigious tournament in a club rugby sponsored by an alcohol company. Ireland's autumn test matches are sponsored by another one. A big drinks company is one of the sponsors of the FAI. Talks about the GAA not being sponsored for the last 5 years. The flood of autobiographies from Irish rugby players over the past decade include detailed accounts of drinking sessions. One account gives a 24-hour bender after Ireland's elimination in the 2011 World Cup. The drinking of the Irish team under Jack Charlton has become part of that legend. And he says, as long as drink remains so tightly woven through our culture, sport will have these problems. And I think that's ultimately the point. If you take a squad the size of Leinster, which is 60 players in their 20s and early 30s, if you take a cross-section, and I appreciate, look, rugby is kind of a particular identity, but if you take a cross-section of any group of Irish males in their 20s and 30s and they go out together, what's going to be the big theme of the evening? Getting locked. That is just the reality.
And there's I
drink and I've had way too much to drink loads of times, and that is part of the culture that we've grown up in. And like all of us, if we're being honest, have drank too much, and this kind of stuff is going to happen.
Yeah, and I mean, there's a massive differentiation between going out and having three or four drinks and going out and getting absolutely locked.
Sure.
All right. And I suppose there's also a big difference, as Shane kind of talks about there, with GAA players and professional sports. So from a practical point of view, right, start of a season. So start of a season as League of Ireland manager. Okay, I bring the players in. We sit down. Here's our aims and plans for the year. You talk about expected behaviours. I would say to them, lads, there's no drinks ban. I'm not telling you that you're not allowed to drink for the length of the season. I'm telling you that you're not allowed to drink the day before a training session. You're not allowed to go out and get absolutely pissed unless there is some sort of an occasion that you've flagged with me and you might be having more than the traditional two or three because of this, and you let me know and maybe I can do something about allowing you off Monday training, something like that. Now, you give them that, you have to trust them with that. You come back to what you're saying about not getting away with anything. So that's the conversation I would have had with the Galway players at the start of the season with Galway United. Halfway through the season, picture appears on social media of a player, one of my players, drinking on a Sunday. We're due to train on the Monday. So it absolutely proves the point that you can get away with nothing. That's at a low level where, you know, League of Ireland, interest in League of Ireland level compared to the Leinster rugby lads. But again, you get away with absolutely nothing.
Yeah.
He's in a position then when I have to sit him down after the train on the Monday, and you pull the picture up in front of him. This is you. This is Sunday. You're having a drink and you have to take action on the back of it.
Yeah.
But they knew the rules, but the rules are nowhere near as stringent as in the GAA side of things, which I think is incredible. How
the drinking,
you know,
man culture.
A very different conversation that the, you know, and from Leash, the Leash hurling or Gaelic football manager is having a very different conversation with his players probably than what I'm having with a League of Ireland squad.
I think from listening to GAA people, players, the drinking ban culture has almost become as much about the damage it does to your physical health as showing them what you want.
Absolutely.
It's like a sign of commitment.
Mm. Mark O'Shea's column in the Mail today, he talks about a fallout with who was the Kerry manager at the time, Jack O'Shea, was it? And do you remember
Jack O'Connor? I'd say was
Jack
it?
O'Connor. Sorry,
is this Gooch and Tomás O'Shea?
That's
is
right.
That one?
Do you remember? Yeah. Do you remember the time obviously that the two lads
dropped? Yeah.
But Mark was drinking that night as well. But there wasn't. He admits in the column. I don't know if this was public news, I hadn't heard of it before, but he admits that he was also drinking that night and another one of the team were drinking that night, but because there was no proof they were able to just say
wasn't me.
No, yeah. It wasn't me. But imagine if he had to have dropped all four for
that'd test you. Yeah. Dropping two is tough. Dropping four, oof.
You're
right,
backing
lads.
Yourself, as he says, it was, you know, he was conveniently willing to accept our explanation, you know.
Can I, as a manager, I presume, so a League of Ireland squad 20, 25, if they were all going out for a big night out together,
yep.
I would say you as a manager are worried. Drink's going to be taken. I'm hoping I'm not getting a phone call at 2 in the morning.
They went out for a night together around mid-season break. I cleared it. The captain came to me, told me the plans. I cleared it and the whole lot. And I did get a phone call the next day over an incident that had happened. It wasn't a major incident.
Sure,
it wasn't a major incident.
Statistically,
it
wouldn't surprise
you. Exactly. It's almost like, you know, you expect when the phone call came the next day, and say it was a small enough incident, not course, major at all, but it was a phone call. I was pretty much expecting, you know, the chances of, particularly when you take the age group that you're talking about here into effect.
I don't think anybody at Leinster Rugby was expecting the phone call that they got.
No.
This is the difference a little bit where, like, sports, as Shay mentions as well, sport doesn't operate in a vacuum to the rest of society. Mm. And people's relationships with alcohol, like, I'm not going to preach, like, everyone has it. Not everyone, some people don't, fair enough.
Yeah.
But, like, people react differently with alcohol in terms of how they behave. So there is a major element of, obviously, with personal responsibility. Mm. Like, if you get to an age where, I don't know, say 25, 30 years of age, and you still can't know what your limits are, that's your own problem.
That's a fair point.
You have to be able to deal with that yourself. And in this instance, it's the reason why it's not interesting, but it's because it's just so disgusting. And that's why it's just disgusting.
Brennan Fanning has a piece on page 8 of the sports section where he says Leinster need to take their culture back to basics. And he starts by remembering Stuart Lancaster taking over the English team after Martin Johnson, when there was the dwarf throwing at the World Cup and the culture seemed to be on its knees, and Lancaster's whole selling point was to say, be humble, don't be arrogant, respect each other and everyone else, to accept the responsibility of being an England player. And it was a real back to basics approach. And Fanning says when he arrived in Dublin, he didn't walk into a playing group who'd been dogged by the same stories, and things have been really positive in many ways. Fanning says, you'd wonder what he has made of events of the last couple of weeks. And then he talks about the Stan Wright situation. He writes, if letting him hang around after the incident, the alleged punch, if letting him hang around was bad enough, then giving him a role in the pageant that unfolded in the RDS beggared belief. As one man who witnessed this unfold said, he was aware of the incident that had happened the night of the game. He said, my blood ran cold when they let Stan up on stage for a chat. Blinded by hubris, writes Fanny and Leinster, played on. They say that Wright has chipped in with an apology as well. Wasn't included in print, says... that may have been on legal advice, but he chose not to make a public comment, and that's been put to bed. And then the urinating issue is currently being investigated. I'm not sure why it takes 2 weeks, but I presume there'll be some punishment of some sort there, and on it goes. But it's been a bad couple of weeks for Leinster, you can say that for sure.
But I don't think, like, saying we're back to basics of the Leinster culture, like, yeah. This is someone urinating on someone here. Like, come on, like, right and wrong. It's not, sure. It's basics. Like,
and nobody's saying it's good. You know
what I mean? Jesus, but that's no. What I mean. But like, if you have some sympathy for some of the Leinster players, are probably reading this and they're probably thinking, Jesus, what are these lads doing when they're going out? But no, this seems to be like a very, well, it's an isolated incident in the level of it, like what this is. And like, the talk of the culture and all that, that's just...
If the investigation does, you know, prove that what's been alleged happened, it's going to seriously tarnish the reputation of the player. It's you know, it's sad in that respect, really, you know.
Yeah, well, we'll let the investigation take its course. Yeah. It seems to, they're saying maybe another 2 weeks and we'll see what the conclusion is. But certainly it's in the papers today, and I suspect not for the last time. It's gone half-time in the 2 o'clock games. Let's go over to Nolan Park. Half-time, Tommy, what's the story?
Hey, Joe, it's 1-13 to Galway, 1-10 to Kilkenny. It was a real cracker now, the first half. Galway's movement up front, like, I was looking at the scores from play, Joe. Like, all but two of the Galway scores have been from play. So they've only scored two frees. Everything else is from play. On the Kilkenny side, all but one has been from play. So they've only scored one free. So that'll just tell you the type of game it has been. Like, it's just guys just taking on each other. Like, the personal duels that are going on are out of this world as well. Like, if Doughty Burke on Colin Fenley, like, Cahal Mannion started on par. Cahal Mannion has scored 6 points from play. He went over onto the wing as well, and there, you know, plenty of movement. Jason Flynn is in on the edge of the square at times on Hugh Lawler, and just, you know, wins ball, sets up goal chances, and with a great save from Darren Brennan. And it's just like end to end stuff. But Kilkenny will have the wind in the second half.
Okay.
So, yeah.
No, you can jump in. I was just saying that's an interesting point, because I was going to ask, you know, how you see this one going. Galway were out of sync against Wexford and Salt Hill, but clearly they're back and playing well today.
Yeah, and I suppose I was wondering before the game, would they be buzzing or would they be kind of playing, you know, with a bit of a lull like they have been playing. Waterford, I suppose, played it like that this year. Tipperary played like that last year, and very hard to get out of them lulls, Joe. But Galway definitely have done it today, because they're just buzzing around. But I probably said it before the game, Galway hurlers and Galway people, they're never afraid of coming to Nolan Park or playing Kilkenny. They've often beaten Kilkenny, and it's their ability to score goals, and that's probably what gave them the great start. It was, you know, it was probably, I think it was about 4 pints each there at one stage. That's when Conor Whelan got the goal and just lifted the whole Galway supporters. And just from there, then it just stayed going and going. And TJ Reid and Cahal Mannion, like, the performances they're putting in here today are worth the admission fee alone. Like, TJ is winning ball and kind of selling dummies and setting up scores and scoring scores. And he's on par with Mannion, who's probably my favourite hurler, you know, of the last couple of years. Just an outstanding wing back, and always comes to games with a battle in mind, and he's under pressure today now versus TJ, because he's just meeting TJ, I suppose, at the top of his game. Who else for Galway is playing well? Midfield, David Burke is definitely after rediscovering some of his best form there at times, and which is definitely a positive for Galway.
Okay. And for Kilkenny, Tommy, 3-point deficit with the win, though, in the second half. Is there anything that they'll be trying to sort out at half-time?
Yeah, well, I forgot to mention Richie Hogan came on after 31 minutes.
Right.
He came on for Adrian Mullen. So I suppose But the talks going around is he has been going well in training. He played a club game for Danes Fort 2 weeks ago and had an outstanding game. So he is in form. So
right.
I think with the win, Joe, we're just hoping to get the ball down, because there is space in both defences to give the attackers chance of scoring goals. So this game could go one way or the other in the second half. I'd imagine it's 1-13 to 1-10. Whoever scores the goals in the second half will win.
Okay. Thanks, Tommy.
Thanks, Joe.
Tommy Walsh there, half-time. Kilkenny trailing by three, but with the win in the second half. And as you heard there, great to hear Richie Hogan's on and back playing well again. TJ Reid is 1-3 to his name, by the way, after that first half. Let's check in at Croke Park. Goals for me, the Mossy 2-6 to Leash's 7 points. This one came alive a little bit then.
It did, yeah. It took a while to get going, Joe, but the last 15 minutes of the first half, it's been very close. Meade got their first goal in the 30th minute. Captain midfielder Brian Menton came bursting through, and Killian O'Sullivan, their wing forward, had made a good run, and Menton timed it brilliantly, got on his shoulder and stepped inside the last defender and finished underneath Graham Brodie's, who's rushing out. So it was a really well taken goal, and in fairness to Leash, they responded quite well. They came up the pitch, kicked another score. They brought on Donny Kingston. I spoke up Evan O'Carroll before the game, and to be honest, he had a bit of a nightmare here today. He did score 3 frees, all pretty straightforward, but he'd 4 wides, dropped another one short, and he was taken off just before half time. Donny Kingston has come on, kicked a good score. After he kicked the score, he actually ran into the Meade defender and kind of left him on his arse, and he only got a yellow. It was hard to see, and they don't show the replay on the big screen here, so it might be interesting to see if there was anything more in it tonight. Probably wasn't, in terms of, it looked like he just kind of continued his momentum and let the defender know he was there. But and then right at the final play of the first half, a big up and under. It was a shot from Brian McMahon, centre forward, and it was actually caught right on the 6-yard box by Meade centre back, who'd gone forward, Donald Keoghan. And he was actually, it was like he was nearly reminiscent of the Joe Sheridan kind of over the line. He was bundled down, and he the ball on his body, I'd say, half a yard out from goal. And Joe McQuillan, the judge, said he was pulled down to the ground. So penalty, which was brilliantly dispatched by Mickey Newman. So that's how the half finished. But yeah, the last 15 minutes were good. And it was it's a 5-point lead for Meade at the moment.
Okay, Mossy, thanks for that. Meade by 5 at half time. Elsewhere in the qualifiers, Monaghan 6 points for Managhan, 1-2 is the latest from Clonus. That one threw in at 1:45, a 1-point lead for Monaghan against Fermanagh. And then a game which is just approaching half time, down 5 points, Tipperary 1-3 at Pádraig Kesslers. Tip lead by 1 is the latest in that game. And as we mentioned, half time at Nolan Park, Galway leading Kilkenny by 3 points, 1:13 to 1:10. Short break, more from David Snaid and Shane Keegan in just a moment. Now, welcome back. Joe here, reviewing the Sunday papers alongside David Snaid and Shane Keegan. We have left behind the Shane Ross section and the Leinster Shame section, which were a lot of fun to talk about, obviously, but let's move on all the same. There are lots of great things in the papers today. There's an interview with Eamon Cregan, which we'll come to. David Walsh talks about a Bridget Scarstein, who I'd never heard of before, and it's a really amazing story. There's an interesting piece on Katie Taylor and Delphine Persoon as well, which will come to. Barry Geraghty's in The Observer. And there's Republic of Ireland, fallout and reaction. It was quite striking. So, I mean, you were obviously at the game, David and Shane. We know your footballing credentials. Eamon Sweeney on page 9 of the Sunday Independent said, regime change has no impact on playing style. He says it was groundhog night in the city of the Little Mermaid, and goes on to talk about the Irish performance against Denmark. He says this performance was very much in the O'Neill mould. As Ireland defended deep, soaked up lots of pressure and sought to strike on the break, Ireland's midfield play was no more cohesive than ever. Our second goal in 5 games against Denmark was like the first one, a header. Talks about the stats, 18 shots to 7, 37% possession Ireland, 3-2-6 passes to 5-5-8 passes, only 65% accuracy, Denmark at 81% accuracy. And says, though, but we should perhaps go easy on the tub-thumping rhetoric about this being a performance that shoved Denmark's disrespectful words back down their throats. They said we were a limited team, and Ireland did in fact give a limited performance, and seems to almost imply that there's an element of PR here about McCarthy and his reign.
Well, I guess when Mick McCarthy got the job, I think Eamon Sweeney kind of hung his colours to the mast fairly promptly, straight away.
He wanted Kenny, I presume, did he?
Yeah, which is eventually going to happen.
Yeah.
What you're saying is correct. Like, no one could look at that and say, oh my God, there's been an amazing transformation of exactly what's changed. What I would say is the 2 goals, the headers, they were both headers from the same player, but they could not have been more different. And that plays into some things, that little aspects of the game that I think have changed a little bit, where Ireland were actually a big threat from set pieces. The one, you go back to the goal in the 5-1 playoff where Duffy scored, I think, I'm pretty certain it was Robbie Brady took a free kick straight on the halfway line straight. It wasn't clear properly, and then Duffy just jumped up and got it. Whereas this was like a few of the free kicks and corners that Ireland took, whipped in well, and there was some really good movement.
Deliveries were excellent, weren't they? Delivery for the goal was outstanding.
Yeah, exactly. And but also the movement. Like, there seemed to have been, it wasn't just a case of, right, we'll lump it in there. Well, like, it seemed to have been done with purpose. And I think it was telling as well. I actually, I had my hands up, I actually got it wrong in the copy. I said it was Seamus Coleman. Took the free kick, was on my head buried in the laptop at that stage. But it was George. So it's telling that the sub was coming on. So they, like they knew we could whip this ball in. They'd obviously been working on it. Yeah. And I thought it was well done. Eamon, like, he is right. Like, no one can sit there and say, well, Ireland were great and played great football. But there was something different. There was definitely, in terms of a kind of a structure and an organisation, but also within the match, Ireland changed how they played. Like, they pressed very high, but then realised, well, actually, it wasn't working that well. Mm. And then, I don't know, I think Corrahan then dropped a bit deeper, got a bit tighter into Whelan, and tried to offer a bit more protection. So I think Eamon's been a bit harsh. Like,
I think he's been very harsh, actually. I thought it's a completely different type of performance from Ireland. In the second half, there's no doubt, and not by choice, there's no doubt they fell back, they defended deep, they lost control of the game, they couldn't seem to get into it. Denmark have good technicians. They're difficult to play against. They're a good team. But in the first half, one, the big comparison with the end of the O'Neill-Keane era, when Ireland were so passive, there was like a real energy about Ireland. There was a purpose. There were runs beyond the ball. I think McGoldrick's been a really good addition. And there were efforts to play football, far more so than we saw in the corresponding game in Copenhagen under O'Neill. And it was interesting, Paul Roan's piece, page 6, Sunday Times, there's the Thomas Delaney, Ireland are a pain in the ass to play against headline, which everyone's jumping in on, of course, and it's a great line. Henrik Dalsgaard says, at least they tried today, Ireland, because before Mick, they didn't even try to play football. It was just kick it away for 90 minutes. It was very defensive, very boring. And that jumped out at me. Second half highlighted the limitations that this team will always have, but I thought there was a real purpose about what they were trying to do. I felt like they all had a similar idea about what they were trying to do in the first half. Shane, where are you coming in on this?
I thought it was a very, very, very Mick McCarthy team performance in the positives and in the negatives. Anybody who thought that Mick McCarthy was going to drastically transform our playing style doesn't know much about football. We were bit better, a decent bit better than we had been under Martin O'Neill. I think, as you say, the players themselves just seem to be playing with a bit more zip about them. I don't think that's massively maybe down to what's been done on the coaching ground. I think it's just down to them feeling a little bit better about themselves, right? Because speaking to a couple of players who played under Mick, that's what he does. Yeah, he makes you feel very good about yourself, and he gives you a very clear, defined role, and he asks you to perform that role to the best of your ability.
That's a completely different.
Absolutely,
that's not the Martin O'Neill. There's no clear defined.
It's not rocket science. It would strike you as the basics, but it wasn't been done under the previous regime, and that's kind of making us look a bit better than we were. It's not making us look fantastic.
But we're not fantastic.
We're not.
We have good players. We do have good players.
Look, maybe I'm. I think.
There's more.
Well, I think when Stephen takes over, I think you will see that this limited bunch of players
are better again
and actually play an awful lot of football. That doesn't necessarily mean getting a result, though, by the way. And Mick has managed to get a really, really impressive result. So I don't mean to be, you know, I'm not giving out about Mick here when I say, I'm just saying that Stephen, I think, will have Ireland playing in a very, very different way. Mm. Mick doesn't have us playing in a dramatically different way, but he's got 11 fellas out there who look like they're enjoying playing football again and look like they'll do anything that is required to do to get a result. And yeah, it's just a feel-good factor, really, around the place that Mick seems to be absolutely brilliant. I mean, he says as much in at the end, actually, Eamon. You know, he's a manager who appeals to our sentimental side, who can deny he cuts a much more pleasant figure in the hot seat than his cranky predecessor.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, that's kind of it.
No, it's true. And there's no doubt they're going to have to find a way to try and regather control of a game when in the second half everything's gone badly and they're under massive pressure, and we still can't seem to quite do that, and that is a massive problem.
We're three games into this group. I know one of them games was Gibraltar away. Did, after what happened in the last campaign, would anyone have thought Ireland would be top of the group after three games?
No. They've got that little bit of luck that O'Neill didn't get.
They really didn't. And for all the talk, like, the players aren't great, but there's some good footballers there, like, in your championship level and then going into the Premier League. Like, Ireland are top of a group when the last campaign, you're coming into this and it was just, you're sort of thinking, just don't get embarrassed, maybe, or just show some sort of signs of improvement. And now, Gibraltar, tomorrow, should be a win, stay on top of the group. And then it's very similar then to what happened in the last campaign when everyone was coming off beating Austria away from home, absolutely buzzing, and then things faded very badly. And that's what hopefully we'll see the true impact of Mick McCarthy is if that doesn't happen with this bunch of players.
John Brennan here has a quote from Mick McCarthy talking about Shane Duffy, who's now everyone's favourite player all of a sudden. Now, is this limiting and in the guise of Trapattoni and O'Neill here, what he says, or is this very complimentary? Because Mick says, he's asked, you know, geez, Shane Duffy, should he be playing even a better league of our Premier League team? And Mick says, he could play in any team, but it depends on what they want him to do. If they want Shane to go and get the ball on the outside of the 18-yard box and pass to the goalkeeper and then roll it to the next one and have 28 passes before it comes out, then no, and he will admit to that. If I want him to defend and put his head in things and block things, stop things, keep it out of our net, he's brilliant at that, so why do anything else?
Well, I'll tell you my exact reading of that.
Yeah.
And it's in the context, I'm reading that in the context of Holland v England the other night, because I think he barely stopped short of saying he's not John Stones, and thank God for that.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's exactly what he's saying there, that this is a fella who knows his role, isn't going to arse around with the ball, and isn't he doing a fantastic job for us. Mm. I'll tell you, for opposition teams, Joe, it's the one real kind of annoyance for opposition teams is you set up a game plan to stop how the opposition play and to try and nullify their main attack and threats and all of that kind of thing. When the opposition's main attack and threat is set pieces, it's a nightmare for a manager. Because you don't know what routines they're going to run, so how can you plan for those routines? And I mean, I'll tell you what, you look back, when you see how reliant we are on set pieces at the moment, what would you give for a Rory Delap at the moment who could turn every throw into a set piece for us
wasn't being done under the previous manager. Like, you can't, not going to kind of just slag off Martin O'Neill because he got us to a Euros and he was successful and then obviously things faded, but it was well known. Set pieces were not something that were properly done. And when you have a weapon like Shane Duffy, it seems absolutely logical that that's where he is. And you have players now like Conor Hourihan, Robbie Brady, who had been doing set pieces. Like, that's where you actually have to say, well, hold on, that's where you have your focus. You have limited time with these players when they're over. Mm. So, you, as I say, the easiest thing to do is get that defensive shape, have that spot on, and then, well, how can we cause the most amount of damage? And it is set pieces. So
it's a grim thought, though, isn't it?
But that's, listen, you work to your strengths, and like, international football, everyone knows, you don't get that much time with them, so that's what you work on.
Not to sound like Nathan here now, but how did we go 90 minutes without Matt Doherty getting on the field again?
Yeah, well,
you explain, you're the manager.
Just right, Seamus is, to my mind, who doesn't adore Seamus Coleman, right? Everybody adores Seamus Coleman, and even when he was going through the blip and there was people putting forward an argument for him just to be left out, not in a million years would have ever left Seamus Coleman out. So, right, let's say Matt Doherty, we want him to play, but he's not going to play right back. When you look, like, we've had two very, very ineffective performances now on the right of midfield in the last two games. Mm. Like, how? I know he wasn't fantastic there the last time, but allow that to build. Allow that. To me, it's...
And he said, yeah, right, you're right. And that's actually something that Doherty said at the start of last week. He was speaking to us. He was like, well, I don't actually think we did that bad. And
I didn't actually think it was that bad against Gibraltar. I was a bit surprised that Mick came out after Gibraltar because it was an AstroTurf pitch on an unbelievably windy day. And it wasn't like McLean and Stevens were doing much on the other side.
Because Doherty hadn't been aware of what McCarthy had said about that, how he basically
shut it down. It's over.
And it was put to him and he was taken aback a little bit. And then he sort of, not went on the defensive, but he sort of said, well, who else played well in that game, really? But what else came off?
I think he's right. If you want to get a look at that partnership again and give it a chance to build, because eight games is a sprint.
Tomorrow is the game.
It's tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you see how they get on tomorrow and you try and build some kind of understanding. But if it doesn't happen tomorrow, then it ain't happening because this thing is a sprint. Like, you're down to how many games after this? Three or four?
Four and a half. OPA we've got,
You know.
And then also, look at it. McCarthy's going to be gone unless we qualify for the Euros next year. So he's probably thinking, well, actually, do you know what? I don't want the grief of trying to make this work. Like, I don't have to.
No, it's a sprint.
But Doherty and Coleman, like, obviously they are rivals, but they're actually very close now around that camp. It's just something that has come out over the last couple of weeks. Like, they will actually, him and with Shane Duffy, those three kind of quite regularly will get together and by all accounts seem to be very kind of chatty about football and talking about the game. It's not just, which is actually interesting because I sort of had it in my head maybe with Doherty, like, Coleman's very kind of, as captain, doesn't like people speaking out and doing certain things, whereas obviously Matt has come out, and I sort of thought maybe, I don't know if they'll be
like that.
Yeah, but by all accounts, and just following up after it, they are quite close as
well.
That
would even lead you to believe they could sort out the partnership themselves, because they're obviously two smart guys. If they like talking football, like, you can chat with each other. Like, you know, when you go in the underlap, what do you want me to do? What's the best thing to do if you're on the touchline and I'm here? And they could figure stuff out together. It would lead you to believe that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And another part of that, Joe, is, and maybe I'm reading a bit too much into it, but like, if you think of that conversation Seamus Coleman was having with Robbie Brady just before Robbie was substituted, you know, the camera zoned in on it there just before. The Seamus Coleman looked like a fella who wasn't overly happy with the job the player in front of him was doing. Obviously, the players can't pick the team, but I suspect that Seamus Coleman would like to see Matt Doherty.
It's definitely one of the subplots tomorrow, for sure.
That's a good point, yeah. But it's also interesting in terms of, like, there's stories within this squad of players. A lot of players, they have good stories. And there's an interview with Scott Hogan.
What's the gist of that?
It's very good. Like, he spoke to the lads. So I'll let Shane discuss it in a bit more detail. Like, I know he spoke to the lads at the start of the week for the Sundays, which always, sometimes you're sort of thinking, well, why would you speak when there's the game on Friday? But normally it's good because it gives you a chance to, they know, well, it's not going to just be about match related. So it gives him gave him a chance to kind of talk a bit more detail about where he's come from and what he's been through to get to this point.
I didn't realise he was such a late bloomer. He was saying 10 years ago he was throwing tyres onto a conveyor belt, was his day job. Earning, what did I say,
260 quid a week.
260 quid a week. Like 10 years ago, that's
it was a recycling plant.
Very, very quick.
Yeah. And where was he working?
In Carrington, just literally around the corner from where Man United and Man City at the time trained.
Okay.
It was like in a recycling plant. And Philip Quinn, he spoke to us Sundays, but Quinner's intro is very good. And I'll just read a quote for it, because I thought it was good. He says, Scott Hogan is lugging tractor-sized tyres onto a conveyor belt in a recycling plant near Carrington. This is his life, and it sucks. He bends, picks up a tyre, and puts it on a belt again and again. Sometimes he switches so the heft changes, but the mindset stays the same. And this is a quote from Hogan. I hate my life. I don't know I don't know where I'm going here. And then it goes into the details. And there's a lot of players in that Ireland squad that sort of discovered myself over the last while who have great stories. Like, these lads, because they aren't maybe of all of the academy variety, have had to work their balls off to get here. And it sort of makes you think that they want to savour every single part of it.
Yeah.
And it kind of just gives you a bit more, from a personal point of view, a bit more interest in them, and a bit more kind of saying, well, actually, hope they do well, you know what I mean? Obviously, they're Irish and the national, so you want them to do well.
I really enjoyed the line, Joe. he's wary of the big boss driving around in a bulldozer who gives him stick for not doing it right. Hogan thinks, how do you throw a tyre properly onto a belt? how wrong can it go?
And was he still involved in football then at an amateur level and pursuing
it? Yeah, exactly.
The Eccles League.
Right.
And eventually, I think it's, by my reading of it, was he was at Rochdale and was let go by Rochdale, but then eventually actually got his first professional contract at Rochdale after a few years bouncing around the lower league. So he hasn't come the conventional route, which kind of always makes players a little bit more enamoured to you, doesn't it?
Yeah, and he's also, as well, Hogan, go back a couple of years, and he was one we were chasing. He had a great couple of years at Brentford, like, absolutely lashing the goals in, and I think he was on the verge to a move to the Premier League, and he picked up an injury. But his agent was kind of sort of saying, well, maybe don't go to Ireland just yet. Kind of, he was one of these as well, who maybe thought, I'm not sure if he thought, but maybe the agent thought, well, there could be England down the line, because this is only 3 or 4 years ago, because he's 27 now.
Right.
So it's just a good story, but it's also a good line how he finishes it, where he says, basically, it's all about winning the game. It doesn't matter who scores. I mean, we could get to the Euros and a striker may score only one goal along the way, but you take that. And that's bang on the head. Like, it really is. Like, and it's a good attitude to have of a striker. He knows he's sort of ready to try and take that one chance. And he came on Friday, pointedly ahead of Sean McGuire.
Yeah.
That shows you where he is in the pecking order now as well. And also, we are talking about subplots with Matt Doherty. That could also be the case tomorrow as well. Will Hogan play? Yeah. Callum Robinson was the other sub who came on. And it's just it's a good story, because it's not, everything's about coverage of the match and all the rest of it, but the Hogan stuff on it is across the Sundays is a bit more personal, and you get a bit of an insight into what he's been through to this point.
Yeah, no, I had no idea. Kilkenny are in big trouble. Galway are flying. 219 Galway, 114 Kilkenny. So that is an 8-point lead for Galway. And Kilkenny are down to 14 men. We'll go over to Tommy Welch in just 1 second and get more meat in the bone of that for you. But 50 minutes gone and Galway lead by 8.
Just on that, Henry Shefflin's column in the paper this morning.
Yeah.
I always enjoy, I think we all do, obviously, I think you always enjoy when somebody gives you a bit of insight and something that you didn't know before. He he starts off by making something that I think will shock absolutely nobody when he says, Brian Cody didn't have any truck with sports psychologists or performance coaches, as they're regularly called now. It was up to yourself to work things out. If you didn't respond to his approach, there wasn't an alternative. But he then goes on to talk about, the reason he brings that up is because obviously it was flagged that Kieran Donaghy had gone in with the Galway Hurlers in, you know, performance coach role or whatever it is. But obviously Galway up until today hadn't really shown much of a performance. So he says up above, even if performance coach isn't Donaghy's official title, I'd imagine it must be a big part of his role. Galway were in Carton House for a training weekend since the Wexford game, and that's the perfect environment for someone like him to interact with the players. It's simplistic to say that they need a little bit of him, but they definitely need something for him right now. As a manager, if you believe there's any benefit to having a performance coach, this is the kind of situation where you hope he will make a difference. Now, in the context of what you're watching, that sounds very, very like it's proven to be the case, you know?
Let's go over to Nolan Park and just get some more info on what's happened here. So 52 minutes, Tommy. Kilkenny 1-15, Galway 2-19, and a red card as well. Who was sent off? What's been going on?
Yeah, so it's now 2-19 to 1-16. TJ Reid is just after scoring a point from a free. Basically, the second half started off just like the first half. Just absolutely brilliant. 1-6 to 6 points if you're looking at the score of the second half. Who was sent off? A short ball went to one of the Galway forwards, and he misplaced the touch. And Paul Murphy was coming in to take the ball off him, but as the ball was mistouched, it kind of went past Paul Murphy, and you know, he kind of met him face on, and it was a red card, second yellow. He got a yellow in the first couple of minutes of the game. So you know what I think on it, harsh. I don't think anyone should be sent off for, you know, mistakes like that, where you're just going in trying to do the right thing and then the ball kind of goes where it shouldn't have and you're just in the wrong place at the wrong time. So it was 1-5 years ago, you know, you'd have a bit of a word with your man. You knew there was nothing, there was no goal chance on, there was nothing really on, and you just say, listen, play on. But listen, it is what it is, and it's 2-19 to 1-16. It's just a score from Paddy Deegan here to bring it back to a 5-point game. A few interesting things. Paddy Deegan, I told you, Cottle Mannion was outstanding in the first half with 6 points. Paddy Deegan is now following him everywhere. Now, he has scored 7 points, but Paddy Deegan is doing a really, really good job. On the other side then, Galway put over Garone McInerney and TJ Reid, but TJ is still having a brilliant second half. But Con Cannon got the goal for Galway. A beautiful pass from Jason Flynn, who was having a serious second half that an ordinary forward wouldn't see. Flynn saw it, Concannon back of the net. But a great second half again, 2-19 to 1-17.
Thanks, Tommy. 55 minutes on the clock. Let's go to Croke Park. Something similar gone on the clock. It's Meath against Laois. Meath still leading, Mossy Quinn.
They are, and they've just added to it, Joe, just as you join us. Wing forward Killian O'Sullivan's after kicking their second point of the half. So it's now Meath 2 goals and 8 points, Laois 9 points. So both of them only got 2 points in the second half. The big moment was in the 39th minute, though, when Laois full forward Colin Murphy burst through on goal and had a brilliant effort that hit the underside of the bar and came out. So from his side's perspective, that was a tough miss. You feel like Laois have kind of forced one or two chances there. Midfielder Kieran Lillis had a chance to score there, pretty straightforward point chance, and he pulled an effort from about 20 yards wide going for goal. And I think it's a bit early to be going for goals, you know, like they are 5 back now at this stage, but I think they still have the guts of 20 minutes left, and they're going to need to up it to kind of keep the scoreboard ticking over. But that's where we are at the moment.
Thanks, Mossy Quinn at Croke Park. Just before we leave the football, and it ties in a little bit with Scott Hogan, you spotted this piece, David, in the Mirror, and it's amazing, really. Ryan Babel, who we're all familiar with. A similar theme to Scott Hogan, you know, Hogan talking about not loving his life for a period. Ryan Babel, it seems, for much of his career has been really struggling, and he's decided to come public with it. He's 32 years old now, Ryan Babel. You still think of him as quite young for whatever reason. And it opens with Ryan Babel has revealed how he's haunted by the paranoid belief that everybody hates him.
Well, first of all, the headline, you see the headline and you see it's an exclusive interview, so right, well, I'll have a quick read. And then I said of the shine and saw it straight away. I was like, what an intro. The intro straight away, you're like, right,
I'll read the next line.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And also just shows you in terms of you're looking at it here, I'd say it's about maybe 450, 500 words. Sometimes you just get straight to it.
Well, when the quotes are this good,
you don't need that, Nils.
The hook is he starts for the Dutch this evening in the Nations League final, and he talks about Kenny Dalglish getting rid of him in 2011, which sparked mental health issues, and more than 8 years on, recently departed Fulham after that six-month spell, he's back looking for a club, but he talks about the lack of confidence. He says, I played for Ajax, Liverpool, Besiktas, Turkey, all massive clubs, and I play for my country, I'm an established international, and yet I know that most people think I should not be selected. I feel this with fans, with media. It's time I touch this subject. I don't think I have to keep quiet anymore. Nobody likes me. He says, for pundits and media, I don't exist. I don't feel sorry for myself, but I do think it's time to express myself and come out with my inner feelings. And the piece goes on to talk about him being born in Amsterdam, like was a massive prospect, broke through at Ajax, went to Liverpool for 14 million in 07. And then 4 years later, he's off to Hoffenheim for 7 million euro. And he doesn't play for Holland for 6 years, between 11 and 17. And just talks about constantly having massive mental health issues because, frankly, he says 9 out of 10 people are telling you you're no good all the time. Basically walking around knowing that nobody rates him very much, and it's a pretty miserable existence, as you might imagine. And then increasingly clubs are turning him down. Says he enjoyed Fulham, but he's looking for a club now again. And I had no idea. You just look at a guy and you think he's oodles of confidence, teenage sensation, Ajax, a bit flamboyant, he's even got his hair, you know, dyed at the moment, like almost looking for attention.
I know.
And you have no idea what's going on with a guy like that.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I think what's the line there as well, where he says, kind of, where is it? If they don't like you, nobody will care about you.
Mm.
It's a sort of stark way of how he, that's obviously how he feels. And I hold my hands up when I was watching the, I'm not meant to laugh about this, because obviously for him, he's coming at this as a very serious
You're
point.
You're part of the problem here, David.
I know, actually, genuinely. Like, I remember when we watched the match on, was it Thursday night that you played England?
Yeah.
And you're sort of thinking this bright, young, vibrant Dutch team coming through, and then you're thinking, what is he doing there?
Yeah.
And
guess what? He's aware that you and everybody
I know. But he always struck me as someone who was just, I would say, totally confident in himself. Yeah. Like, even like players get knocks and maybe they just give off this facade, and then you saw him come back and he's in Fulham in a relegation battle and his head looks like a lollipop, like a red lollipop. And you're sort of thinking, pal, you're not doing yourself any favours here whatsoever. Like, your team are a shambles, you're playing brutal, and you've got bright red hair. But he clearly is a deeper fella. He's obviously, the stuff, it's grim what he says, I think, a little bit. It's kind of how he feels about how people view him.
Well, he has spent a decade feeling hated.
Yeah, must be tough.
Incredibly tough. So fair play to him for coming out and talking about it. He'll be playing for the Dutch this evening. He is looking for a club, it seems.
Yeah.
But he's talking about enjoying his football again with Fulham. He did enjoy football, and talked about getting lots of messages on social media saying that he was doing well. He said, I've gone from scratch to the top again. In 2 years, my life has gone from below freezing point to being hot again, is how he finishes. So hopefully you can get things together for
should
the last
couple
should
be an interesting game later, that one, actually.
Yeah?
Yeah.
So it should.
I'm sorry, one final thing.
Yeah, go on.
He's 32.
Yeah.
I always saw him as this flying winger, but maybe sometimes, like, it's one regret a lot when you speak to players, and you know, as players always say, the one regret is, by the time they actually kind of understand the game, it's too late, that they're older and their legs have gone. So maybe if he actually has this perspective and kind of maybe could be a bit more of a focal point, it could be interesting to see how he does for the next couple of years. He could actually be one of these players who has a totally different... kind of ends of his career, and in 10 years' time, people could view Ryan Babel totally different.
Piece I enjoyed the most all day, Eamon Cregan with Philip Lanigan, page 82 and 83. The Mail on Sunday is brilliant.
Yeah,
Eamon Cregan has legendary status, obviously, anyway. And I think after this interview, everybody just wants to give him a hug and say, you are the man.
Like I said it to you before I came in, and I'll hold my hands up, and this shows you my kind of ignorance with GA matters. I had no idea who he was, and I just loved it from start to finish.
Yeah.
Like, from it, like, and like, even with Shane, we were just chatting about it, you brought it up as well, and just sort of like, I feel from today, like, I hope someone gives him a phone call at the end of the match, make sure he's all right.
So this starts with Eamon Cregan. If you're not familiar with Eamon Cregan, I mean, you've definitely come across him one way or another. 1973, he was on that Limerick team that won the All-Ireland, famous batch, obviously, especially in Limerick. And he managed Offaly in 94 against Limerick in the great comeback, which, as Philip Lanigan writes, that a catch 22 that Joseph Heller could hardly have dreamt up, which is a great line. So he's talking here about the All-Ireland final and just recent events. He's been still involved in hurling right the way through. Basically, one way or another, he talks about it throughout the piece. He's been involved with all of these current players and managed Mary Eye up until 2016 when they won the Fitzgibbon in February 2016. He was manager then, and then he decided to call it quits. But like, the hook, the starting point of this is that during the All-Ireland final, last year, Eamon Cregan finds it so difficult to watch it. His blood pressure gets so high, and he was due to have a procedure a few days after the All-Ireland final, presumably related to his heart, that while Limerick were winning the All-Ireland last year, Eamon Cregan was hoovering his wife's car.
Yeah. Hoovering dust that wasn't there, as he says himself.
Unbelievable.
I know.
He must really, really suffer with it. Like, imagine being a Limerick person, just any Limerick person, and not watching those final minutes, let alone be possibly the Limerick person most associated with Limerick hurling over the last few decades. For him not to be able to sit through it, you feel sorry for him to a certain extent.
Yeah. That's what sport does, I should say. It just can kill you, really, can't it?
It seems like he was almost doing it for his health as well. I don't go to them anymore, the matches, that is, because I get too upset when I see Limerick being beaten again. And he says, imagine me going to that match and me being in that situation in the last few minutes. I would have had to get up and walk out because the blood pressure goes sky high. He says, I had to go for a procedure the following Thursday in St. John's. So I said, no, I'm not going to the All-Ireland final. He said, Anne, I'm not watching it. And he went out and hoovered the car.
Like, we're not spoiling things by kind of quoting some of the stuff, because it is all two pages.
Yeah,
it's great. And like I'm not just saying it because Philip's a former is a former colleague, because it hooks you. And that's why, because I didn't know much about it, so I started reading it. And I'm sort of I'm sort of understanding it a little bit in terms of the nerves. As a supporter of a team, you're like, sometimes you can just be in ribbons, you know what I mean? But the bit where he says, where, like, I'm hoovering the car, every so often I'd run in and get an update. On this occasion, I got a text from my daughter, Cuiva. She says, Limerick winning. Like, you can just imagine that kind of Limerick winning. Right? Yeah. So he runs back in, and the score, like, they're well ahead. He goes, right, the match is over. And then he's thinking, so it's right, it's half three. It's a half three start. It's going to be over. Game's over. And he goes back in. And he gets back in quoting again. Next thing, when I came in, there was Joe Cannon lining up the free to level. Just at that moment, oh shit. I thought and turned and ran. And ran out. And then, because I didn't know anything about him, I'm reading this. And then you get that sense of how much he just loves Limerick and how much it kills him.
But essentially,
he beats them.
Exactly, he blames himself for the fact, obviously, that they have gone so long without it, given the Offaly game and his involvement with Offaly at the time. So it's almost like a massive, massive weight got lifted off his shoulders last year, which is doesn't make sense, really, for him to look at it in that sense, that he was at fault for it.
So it's one of those pieces where you look at it and you think, Jesus, there's a lot in that, but you read it and finish it and you're like, where did that go? Because it's like, you just keep on going. The one of the lines from Philip where he says, no, after when he was the Offaly manager, which is, he just says the Offaly thing, he says, no winning manager has experienced a part of his heartbreak in the same moment.
No, it's a great line.
It's a good line. Yeah. Like, and it just sums up perfectly, and it's a very good piece. Like.
Yeah, interesting fella. I read a book by Lynn McTaggart. She was into projecting your thoughts into people. She maintains that if 300 people sat in a room and all thought of just one thing, there will be no crashes on the roads today. All saying it together, the crash rates of cars would drop. If the negative thoughts come in, I've spoken to a number of people who were there, it was, oh God, we're not going to lose this again. And then he talks about it later on with Fitzgibbon
Cup final.
He's like, Mary, I are going to win. Mary, I are going to win. Mary, I are going to win. I was trying to project my own thoughts onto the players. And that's how he signed off. So,
Shane, you were
incredibly likable fella.
You were saying his dad or something had the same
thing? Yeah, he obviously didn't lick it off the ground. He says it up further. His own father, Ned, died in August 1972. He stopped going to matches years before then. He used to get too excited and it was bad for him. So it's definitely a family trait. It's very, very nice as well. He talks about the homecoming and he's praising, obviously, like everybody, he's praising John Kiley and Paul Kinnock and Caroline Curd. But he says, I met them at the train station. My niece embarrassed me. I was standing over by the corner of Perry Street and People's Park. The bus was turning. She roared at the lads above, and next thing Sean Finn heard her roaring and she was pointing at me. Sean suddenly saw me. That was it. I was happy. Eye contact from a player who he'd coached all his life, who was now on a bus celebrating win. That's all he needed.
Be centre of attention. Yeah.
It's great. It's great. Even just from a kind of a work point of view, a technical point of view, the actual spread it works brilliantly, because like, the picture is great, because you can imagine that's how he actually, whenever he does kind of ever watch a match, that's probably how he...
He's got his hands over his face watching the game somewhere.
The headline, Unbearable Devotion as well. So
We've gone way over, so actually, you guys need to pick quickly here. Barry Geraghty is in The Observer talking about his determination to come back from a terrible leg break, and we wish him well. Joe Brawley's writing about Donegal Tyrone, definitely slamming Mickey Hart's tactics. Colm O'Rourke's talking about Stephen Cluxton and his incredible legacy as he makes a 100th championship appearance. There's US Open pieces as well, from Dermot Gallese to Philip Quinn to an interview with Montgomery, Colm Montgomery, in the Mail on Sunday. We won't have time for any of that. Choose, Shane, as one last kind of quick piece between the stuff on Katie Taylor and Delphine Persoon and drug testing, or Birgit Skarstein, David Walsh, Sunday Times, whichever one you want.
I'm glad you pronounced her name and I didn't have to. Well, I'll just call it the David Walsh piece. So,
okay,
Look, I arrived in and had read most of the stuff that you had sketched out as possible talking points. That was the only one that probably that I hadn't read. So I said I'd throw my eyes at it, and it's brilliant, isn't it?
She's a proper legend.
As you say, when you're... when there's so much other negative stuff going on in sports, you need these kind of stories every now and again. And actually,
nobody urinating on anybody
exactly,
in this whole story.
Exactly. In fact, David actually starts the piece talking about some of the negatives in sport.
I wasn't sure if that was necessary. Like, he details the rape allegations against Neymar and Ronaldo for like a good third of the first column, two thirds of the first column, and you're almost like, her story doesn't need you to point out that bad things happen. You know,
no, he's doing what you've just said there. That you said nobody's urinating anybody here. He's doing the same.
I feel like I didn't want to come into work today to talk about that, but, you know, events. Anyway, he highlights that not everybody's a great role model, and then talks about this person that nobody has heard of who's been in the Winter Olympics.
Her mental strength is just absolutely phenomenal. She suffered a freak accident that I think initially they didn't think was too bad. She got an operation done on the back of it, and unfortunately the operation just seemed to go horribly, horribly wrong.
This, by the way, was scary. Like, she's 19 years of age. She's from...
Oslo,
yeah, just outside Oslo. And she's got a spare year, so she goes off with her mate to work in an orphanage in Thailand. You know, very admirable thing to do. So she's having a swim, and she cuts her ankle on what she thinks was just domestic trash in the water. And it becomes infected, bacteria, flies back to Oslo, parasite in the foot. On it goes. There was talk of amputating the leg, and then there was... Her uncle was involved, who was qualified in the area. He said, no, we can get things back. And she had an epidural as part of the operation. And long story short, there were a load of mistakes made, and she emerged from that paralysed from the waist down. Now, there had been a big fallout, and they've had to completely do over practices in that Oslo hospital. It doesn't help her walk again.
No, but her mindset, her ability to deal with it all just seems to be remarkable mental strength. There's no feeling sorry for herself. There's no blame game. Quite the opposite, actually. I mean, she talks about... She's not interested in compensation. She wasn't interested in blaming anybody. But she did want a full and thorough review done for the simple reason that she didn't want it to happen to anybody else.
Yeah. Because the issue was budgetary cuts, she says, meant staffing levels at the hospital had become dangerously low. People were off sick, and the anaesthetist who performed the epidural was working a double shift, had been awake for a long time. The injection shouldn't have touched my spinal cord, but that's where it ended. So, you know, like, what a horrible thing to have to... digest and live with. And for people who've hurt themselves on swings recently, look no further than her saying the thought of suing the hospital never crossed her mind. They didn't mean to do me harm, they made a mistake.
Absolutely. And she's so matter of fact about everything. So she's like, even obviously she doesn't mean to be rude here at all, but she just, in the early days, friends would say, you will walk again, just believe, and she would reply, look, if you have some information that suggests I may walk, show it to me, because I haven't come across it.
Yeah.
Do you know? And again, later on in the piece, her way of kind of not justifying it all, but to come out with the line, some people win the lottery, some people get hit by a car. That's how the world is.
She has gone on to become a city councillor in Oslo. She has been on the case of the hospital. She says, I became their pain in the ass to make sure practices recommended on after what happened to her have been implemented. So she's actually turned up at the hospital to make sure that what they said they were going to do has been done. And she's been at the Winter Olympics. She's won 3 world championships as well in rowing. So she's not only been at the Winter Olympics, she's going to be in Tokyo next year as a rower. So she's been a Paralympian in the Winter Olympics. She's now just going to the Summer Olympic Games, even though paralysed from the waist down. She's going to be a rower, and she's won world championships. So if I want
she's
anyone to...
I was just going to say, there will be nobody who reads this piece and doesn't go looking for this girl next year
100%.
And cheer her on with every ounce of their being, you know?
Yeah, what a legend. Good way to finish. Birgit Skarstein, and she was paralysed at the age of 20. So she's turned things right around. The Katie Taylor piece is interesting as well. They're just talking about, it seems if the Delphine Persoon fight is going to happen again, the Taylor camp will insist that they sign up to the voluntary drugs testing
protocol.
Yeah. Yeah, 30 grand a year. But they reckon the promoters will absorb it, and Taylor has the kind of clout now to mean that that's affordable. It's worth a read. It's Sean McGoldrick in the Sunday Independent. It's a good piece. We might come back to it at some stage this week. We're pretty much out of time. Sorry, I know we always will get caught for time. But thanks very much to David Sneyd and Shane Keegan. We'll take a short break. More on the hurling and the football, which is on at the moment, in just a second.
The Sunday Papers on Off the Ball.